That was hysterical.
That is hysterical.
Yeah.
Yeah, CASA's in the building today, and it's one of our favorite organizations for lots of reasons. And so we got kind of, I got derailed getting here by them, and I just derailed the committee on it too. So I'm sorry, we're taking your time, and we should be listening to you. But you work for these people too, and you know how wonderful they are. So this is the Subcommittee on Human Services. This is March 19th. It's a Thursday. It's 8:37 in the morning. Sorry, we're starting late. This is a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526. Oregon Health Authority, Addictions and Mental Health. We'll be hearing from Pam Martin, Karen Wheeler, and Amy Baker. And would you like to talk to us about what's going to happen today?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, today we will finish up on AMH Community Services. And I will add that the director, Lynn Saxton, is going to start out with some comments at the beginning of today's meeting.
Good morning, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here with you today, and I wanted to provide a little frame for the discussion today and share some exciting advances at the Oregon Health Authority. One of the things that is critical to Oregonians is a functioning and integrated system of mental health care, and many steps and many advances have been made in the last years, and the Oregon Health Authority is proud to be able to take those advances and move them forward in the restructuring that we will be announcing today to our staff. We made the first round of announcements last Thursday to senior leadership, and we'll be continuing that work today. I wanted to share it with you today because we'll be bringing back to the committee in April what I am going to call, for lack of a better word, a map of mental health services in Oregon. As many of you know, for people and children with mental health issues, there's usually a continuum of need and services that need to connect to ensure that children and families and the adult population get what they need, and particularly get what they need in the right order, at the right transition point. And from all of our perspective as Oregonians, we need to ensure that that system is both evidence-based, best practice, but also financially sustainable, so that we can ensure that these services meet the needs of a very critical population for all of us. Today, we will be sharing with our team a realignment of the medical assistance programs, the organization formerly known as DMAP, and the addictions and mental health branch services that currently are aligned with the CCOs or need to be aligned with the CCOs. Both those areas will be relocated under the leadership of our chief health systems officer. That position is being posted. We have not hired that position yet, but Linda Hammond, a very experienced hand and leader in state government, will be overseeing those operations as we make this very significant transition. Our hope and our expectation is that in aligning those services in the manner we're proposing, we will have closer integration with the coordinated care organizations. We will have the data capacity to look at how services work together and connect, and what the return on investment and outcomes of those services are. And most importantly, we will meet the needs of children, families, and adults with mental health in the most effective manner possible. And we're very excited about that. I want to underscore that this is significant work. This integration and relocation and restructuring work is challenging. As you know, our staff is about 4,500 people. About 2,000 of those people work at the Oregon State Hospital. So as we do this, we will be keeping a sharp eye to three things. First, how is it that we are effective and efficient? It's very critical in this realignment and this restructure that we factor in efficiency, because as you all know, we have to address the financial sustainability of the system of healthcare that we are building. Yeah. Second, we will look at what our partners in healthcare delivery are doing right now. We don't need to duplicate what the CCOs are doing. We need to acknowledge, understand, and work side by side with them to ensure that if the services they're able to offer are not duplicated, but also services that are not yet in place in many parts of the state are created. And so we will be using our resources to ensure that if you have mental health issues, your services are available to you in an integrated best practice manner. And finally, and this is very important, finally, we will be looking specifically at the client needs as opposed to our needs as an agency or the CCO's needs or all the other needs out there. The most important thing in delivering effective mental health services is to view it from the client and family perspective. These are very complex services to deliver well. Mental health issues do not occur Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. They occur 24/7. They require integration at the highest and most expensive levels of healthcare in the hospital setting, all the way into the individual's home and physical setting of their daily life. They require a 21st century attitude towards mental health, which is a commitment to recovery and a quality of life that all of us expect in our daily living. So we're very excited about beginning this work. We're very cognizant of how very complex and difficult it is, but we are well on our way to both setting the platform for your policy making around mental health and look forward to bringing to you in April probably the first time that the state has mapped mental health services by the continuum, by the return on investment and outcomes, and by the geography, which is a critical factor in our rural-urban culture. You'll be hearing today about the MOTS system, and MOTS is a system that ties outcomes to measures, and Pam will talk to you about the implementation phases of that and where we are in developing that. We'll be using that tool, but we will also be using the other tools available to us, particularly our metric system, which was developed for health system transformation, that is our ability to work with CCOs and identifying the things we need to have them accomplish for our health system to be successful. So with that, I'm going to pause and answer your questions. I have to say that when I was first asked to consider this position, one of the highest priorities that was given to me was to look at the mental health system in Oregon in great detail and with an eye to what clients need as opposed to what we create for them. And it will be an honor and privilege to support your efforts and the CCO efforts and our own team's efforts to get this work done.
Questions?
Thank you. Well, knowing that you come out of the field of mental health with children, I know you bring a huge context in it, and I know you're a very bold person. You also look at systems from the early childhood. So it's still breathtaking to me that you've been there 6 weeks and have this new vision. So I guess my question is, was this already kind of in the works? You've laid out really wonderful principles about integration, and that's been our biggest challenge. And I think the addictions piece is also a huge. It's the stepchild, and there's been a lot of articles in the Oregonian and Willamette Week. So I'd love it if you could address, you know, how that fits in. But was this already kind of in the works, or was this just a fresh eye? And I'm guessing, having seen Margaret Van Fleet and the Housing and Community Services, you know, 2 years of doing a whole reorganization, a lot of stakeholder input. I'm just wondering, have you been able to go outside the agency, get any kind of stakeholder input, and or how do you plan to do that going forward?
So three questions. In terms of was this already in the works, I think throughout Oregon, many stakeholders, many of them on this dais and many of them sitting behind me and many in the community, have for years been working towards better outcomes and better services in the mental health sector. So other people's work is what we're going to secure and implement. Mm-hmm. I will say that in the I had been in this position for 2 weeks, and I got a call from the governor's office saying, we'd like to see your restructure for the Oregon Health Authority. And I was relieved and pleased that actually I'd completed it the night before, that homework thing with your teachers. Yep, got it. And I've had the opportunity to review this restructure with the with then Governor Kitzhaber and now with the governor's office and with other stakeholders, and they're excited about what they see. The stakeholder part of our engagement on this transformation, on this change, begins this afternoon with the CCO meeting that they host monthly and we attend, and then begins in great detail on March 23rd with literally hundreds of groups, including a strong partnership that we hope to develop with the housing community. So I think the exciting part is that with the standing up of the metric system that we have and the data framework that many of our partners are now working with, really for the first time we have the opportunity to integrate best practice information and client-focused services. And so I think we'll be executing in that manner. It is important to note, and I'm excited about what we're going to bring back to you in April, that we really do need to look at this issue from the perspective of how many people need care and services, what do those services look like over time. Mental health is not a surgical intervention. It's often a long-time intervention. And then specifically how we deploy our financial resources and where we deploy them geographically to ensure that we truly have, I think, what we all want, which is an integrated system of mental health care.
Senator Steiner Haywood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kenny Geyer did a great lead into the first part of my question, which is that major change is scary. You and I have had this conversation already, and it sounds as if what you're proposing is going to involve some pretty major changes. And so one of the things I'll be interested in hearing, and you may have some comments about it now, but I expect you'll have more when you come back to us in April, is how you plan to manage the culture change, and not just the big stakeholders who are sort of close to the center, but the people who've been providing a range of services around our state for decades, and who have an investment in the way things are now. So I'll look forward to hearing about that in whatever ways you want to tell us. But that's important to me because I do think, as you do, that we need to respect the work that's been going on in our communities, even though we recognize it needs to change. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing is, I apologize for being late. I was tied up. You may have mentioned this before I came in, but is it a fair assumption to say that what you're going to propose will involve deconstructing mental health being run primarily by the counties? Or is that going to be, I'm interested to think about how we're going to do that, because right now it's primarily the counties that have lead responsibility for mental health services in the community. So I'll be interested in your thoughts about that as well.
So two things, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, Senator Steiner Haywood. One is culture change is complex, and I think what we have is the tools that we need to do it. I think we have the energy, and I think we have the focus, and I think that's key. In terms of the counties and the other stakeholders, we have counties in the state who are really doing exemplary work tied to their horizontally integrated partners and delivering the outcomes that clients need. The map that we bring to you in April will be the preliminary look at where those other gaps occur, and I would suggest they're throughout the system. The people who provide the services across the board, hundreds of providers provide the mental health system. I think this will be a lot of work. I don't want to minimize that, but I also think that having metrics that show us how we're doing and what results we're getting will be our North Star. That's a Linda Hammond word, but I like it. And and we will use the combination of the metrics and a well-organized effort to do this to ensure that they are, that they make the advances that we need to make. And again, outcomes are the goal here, and we're not talking process outcomes, we're talking client level outcomes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on the changing the culture issue a little bit, and you and I met yesterday, and I on the record, I'm just very pleased with the direction that you're headed. You know, understanding that it is a big challenge for you, and I've worked with Linda Hammond before, and she's an outstanding, by the way, when we did the work on the state hospital and bringing those stakeholders and everybody, particularly my community, together, and she just did an outstanding job. I'm going to, you know, go out on the limb. This is one legislator who is actually pleased with the direction that you're taking. And I would just say, when you encounter some of those barriers that are going to be there, that you're open enough to share those with us, because some of us will get your back and help you with it. This has been long overdue. Some of us have been extremely frustrated with us not having, quote, a system. And, you know, the plan that you're putting forth is talking about taking fragmentation and building it into a system. And so I commend you. We know that's not something I do that's going to happen overnight.
Right.
We know that there's a lot of stakeholders and individuals that have to be engaged and involved with you. So I'm just looking forward to the layout of the plan and actually the delivery of the plan.
Thank you.
I'll make a quick comment. We got to get you out of here by 9 o'clock. You've got another meeting to go to, and you have to lay your program out. So some of us go back a long ways in these issues. I remember Mr. Mink back in early 2000. And I'm hoping that this is going to be a big change for us. And I'll say good luck.
Thank you.
And I'll say good luck. And the way you say it, one is good luck and one is a little sarcasm, okay? But I do mean it, good luck. This is going to be a tough thing to change. There's a lot of inertia out there. When you start talking about the things we're just in mental health we're talking about here, I'm glad to hear you say some counties are leading the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of five or six of which Marion mm-hmm. County is one of the best. Okay, mm-hmm. They're really doing a great job. So looking at the counties that are leading the way means that basically we have to get out of their way, support them, and bring the other counties along also.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're going to do that, but you've got to get your organization lined up right to do it. And you've got a lot of inertia over there. I really mean it. Good luck. You know, and as far as the North Star thing, remember that Magellan left Portugal with five ships, 287 men. He didn't make it past the Philippines. The last ship made it through with 18 people aboard. It's a long, tough voyage to do these things. I hope you don't lose everybody along the way, most importantly, yourself.
Thank okay. you. We have a very talented team at the Oregon Health Authority, and I think this structure is going to ensure that they can be collaborative partners with the community.
So I'm going to stop this conversation because she really has to get going. And
thank you.
In deference to your time, thank you for coming and speaking to us. And really, good luck.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Pam Martin, the Director of Addictions and Mental Health at the Oregon Health Authority, and with me is
Karen Wheeler, Behavioral Health Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division.
And Janelle Evans, Deputy Budget Director for the Oregon Health Authority.
So it was great to have Lynn in this morning because I think she provides a lot larger context so that when you hear about some of the things I'm going to talk about today and some of the things that we've been talking about for the last 2 days, you can see that they are, again, a foundation for a better system moving forward. And I'm going to be very mindful of the time and hope to finish the entire presentation in an hour and still be able to address any questions you have. So the first thing I wanted wanted to talk about.
I
want to
screw things up by asking something of the committee right now. We may not have time to get completely through this. Do you want to let her do her entire presentation and then ask questions, or do you want to ask questions as we go along?
Presentation.
Okay, so we're going to do a presentation, no questions, but we will be saving questions and bringing them to you at end of your discussion. Okay?
You're getting ready.
Okay, and I've...
Thank you, Senator Bates.
Kenny Geyer, don't have that in blood. Okay. Senator Steiner Haywood, don't have that in blood. Okay, good. Forward.
Thank you.
I do deserve that comment.
So I think we all agree there's no health without a home. So one a very important recovery support service is in housing. We have several different supported housing programs. One of them serves about 600 people per year. It's directed towards people with severe and persistent mental illness and includes people helping to find housing, to follow up with support services while people are in permanent scattered site housing. And it provides $1,000 for moving in expenses, first and last month's rent and utilities, things like that, as well as up to $500 a month for rental support. It's another program that has a has been very successful in Oregon is called Oxford Houses. Oxford Houses are sober, completely clean and sober rental houses. We hire a firm, a nonprofit called Oxford House Incorporated, who creates these houses. We have 158 of them with over 1,200 people living in them. There are men's houses, women's houses, and houses for women and children. 85% of the men who live in these houses have touched in some way the criminal justice system. They've been incarcerated, and 75% of the women. The rates for relapse nationally are about 20% after having lived in an Oxford house for an average length of stay of about 6 months. But in Oregon, it's actually the relapse rate is quite a bit lower, at about 3%. Another foundation of recovery is employment. And I'm not going to talk too much about peer-delivered services, except to say that we have a number of people, hundreds of people, who have now been certified as peer support mentors, traditional health workers, and peer and family support people. I just want to say that most of them are being paid in the organizations through grants. And they're not billing directly. So this is something in terms of workforce issues that I think we're going to have to address as we go on. But we do have a wonderful supported employment program as well. And the gentleman who you see is Robert Hazen. This is a young guy who is a family man, has two kids. He's given us permission to tell his story. He was in prison after being started on drugs at age 13 by an adult member of his household. Now he's in college with a B average, and he was somebody who was in our supported employment program and did and is now working and is now in college. So this employment is critical for people's long-term recovery, self-esteem. The new investments were critical in increasing the number of people served. This is the map showing the dark blue are the programs that were available before the new investments, and then now this is a program that we have that is completely statewide. Okay. We also, not only do we support the people who are in recovery, we support the entire system. One important way is, as you've heard throughout our presentation, you've heard us talk about centers of excellence. Centers of excellence are occur or need to occur when a system is at a certain developmental stage. We don't need a center of excellence around ear infections. Ear infections are well understood. There's a lot of research. We have many, many skilled providers and practitioners. However, probably at one time when it might have been important to have a special audiologist or some sort of center for people to learn about this. In all the centers of excellence that we have in Oregon right now are to help us promote evidence-based practices, to help programs meet fidelity, and to take advantage of national research and national programs that are going on. I say this because I think eventually, when, say, adolescent depression screening is completely embedded in our integrated physical and health systems and behavioral health systems, we won't need a center of excellence around that. We won't need the special assistance from the Oregon Pediatric Society, but right now we do. So we have the Addiction and Technology Transfer Center, which is from SAMHSA. These relationships with the Oregon Health and Science University, with Options for Oregon around supportive employment and assertive community treatment. And this is to help us develop and implement and assess and eventually bake all of these elements into programs. So next. We also do housing development. As everybody is aware, the vacancy rate in Portland and in Bend is from between 1% and 2%. It's very difficult to find housing. So short term, we stress the need for scattered site rental assistance and supports for people. But at the same time, we know we have to be doing some literal building of services. We have to work with partnerships with community housing programs to actually build new structures for people to live in. The last legislative session, $5 million of the tobacco tax was used to form a partnership between AMH, NAMI, and Oregon Residential Provider Association to develop housing for people with mental illness. And we have other housing development. You can see on the slide, these are competitive application processes, and they help us build, so for example, 10 supported housing projects for a total of 33 units for people with mental illness. Now, this is really taking, this is unit by unit, apartment by apartment, duplex by duplex. This is the long-term building of the system, but it absolutely has to be done. So we try to strike a balance between the immediate needs and then in building over time. We also support the system by having the Health Professional Services Program. Tragically, along with the general population of people who become addicted to substances, health professionals are particularly vulnerable because of the accessibility of prescription medication. So we have a program that supports public safety while helping licensed health professionals such as nurses continue with their careers. It would be tragic and short-sighted to have these people disappear from our healthcare system and our workforce, because as we know, with support, people recover. And so these are programs that help 260 people a month enrolled in those programs. It's our vendor for this program is Reliant Behavioral Health. At the same time, we are supporting the existing system, and as you heard today, working very hard to improve the system. One of the things that I'm very proud of that we've done in the last 2 years is to create an Office of Consumer Activities, and I'm not going to call him up, but let me introduce Mike Liebichek, who's in the audience.
Mike is the very first director of the Office of Consumer Activities for the Oregon Health Authority, and there's one other staff person, Nicole Currier. And both Mike and Nicole have the lived experience that's so important to bring to this position. It was a recommendation to me by the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council that we create such an office. And we, at that time, Oregon was one of only 6 or 7 states that did not have something like this. And this is different from the ombudsman's position. Mike and Nicole are developing a leadership network. They're doing a lot of visiting around the state, trying to find out where peer-delivered services are working, who's hiring those folks, how they're being used. Mike and Nicole, as part of our strategic plan, are working on an anti-stigma campaign for mental health and addictions, and very exciting prospect of a peer conference that's going to happen in September or October of this year that will bring together people from all over Oregon to talk about peer support and the work that they'll be doing. It's an amazingly effective and important part of our healthcare system going forward. Peer delivered services for navigation for health and wellness, and just to be the bridge between science and practice and recovery is very important. So we're so happy to have Mike and Nicole on board and doing that work.
Okay, good morning. I'm Karen Wheeler again, and I'm going to talk about the mental health new investments for just a short period of time. First of all, I'd like to again recognize the leadership efforts of Senator Courtney and this entire body for making these new investments in 2013 and 14. The new investments were highlighted throughout this presentation, so you've heard about some of them. They were conceptualized based on a multi-stakeholder process that occurred in the mid-2000s, and the report called the Community Services Workgroup Report that was completed in 2007. Again, Pam will talk about later that we did a multi-stakeholder process in developing a strategic plan, and as we went around the state and talked with hundreds of stakeholders, these new investments were definitely a topic of discussion, and people were very happy about them and thanking the leadership of Oregon for making these happen. To award the funding, AMH solicited proposals from units of local government, nonprofit organizations, CCOs, and we also engaged in a partnership with the tribes to provide some capacity funding for tribes to develop mental health services. Some of them had not ever had that capacity before, so that was very much appreciated by the tribes of Oregon. We also partnered with the Public Health Division to allocate the school access to mental health services, which you heard about yesterday, and hopefully you'll hear more about as well. This whole entire process was a huge lift for our division and resulted in at least 169 contract amendments and new contracts that were let out. So I'm not going to belabor all of these investments, and I'll just say that the next 3 slides provides you with a line-by-line detail of the title of each investment, the amount of funds that were committed to each one, and the impact statement about what has happened in a very brief way, how these have impacted getting capacity to communities throughout the state of Oregon. And I will mention that some of them are brand new. There was no capacity that currently existed before the new investments. And after the new investments, new capacity exists. Things like Opal K, which you've heard about, and other programs, youth hubs, for instance. So again, I'm not going to go through each of these slides. You can read them. I will also mention that in December, I provided a report to this body, and that report is on record. We are in the process of updating all of the data that comes to us from our contractors every quarter. So the report in December was based on the data that we had at that time. And right now, we're developing our own internal report and summarizing what we're getting from each contractor. Okay. And then to just wrap up my piece, I think I mentioned that we transitioned the alcohol and drug residential system to CCOs, and that happened effective July 1st, 2013. That, again, was quite a lift for our division as well as medical assistance programs. That involved numerous stakeholders, providers, counties, CCOs, as well as our divisions. So they now contract and manage the entire system from detox, residential, to outpatient care. AMH still pays the room and board for those services. So I want to thank you again for requiring us to increase the room and board rates for youth residential and adult residential treatment. That's definitely helped the providers out. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen. So the largest system improvement that we're going to talk about, that we've talked about in the last 3 days, is the implementation of the measurements and outcome tracking system. This is a project that started in 2012. There was a realization that there was no way of finding outcome measures for non-Medicaid funding. In other words, Medicaid, you put in a bill for what you did, and a great deal of information can be gleaned from that encounter data: who the provider was, how much it was, what was done, what the diagnosis was. So most of the Medicaid information is from encounter data. There's no similar system for the non-Medicaid funding, and yet that's where a lot of the addictions work is done, and all these other systems you see. So the MOTS system replaces one of these systems that's like over 30 years old, and it's taken a few years to develop. But at this point, there are over 150,000 clients who are enrolled in the MOTS system, whose information is put in. There are 223 provider organizations put data in each time, you know, for every 3 months, so we have a look at what happens to people over time. Any behavioral health practitioner who receives public funding is required to put this information, and it's client specific. So, for example, we'll know if someone's use of substances was reduced because of treatment. We'll know whether or not they've had criminal justice involvement, whether they've been incarcerated, if they went on probation, if they went on parole. We'll know if their school functioning improved. We'll know if they're employed, and if so, what kind of employment they're in, including if they're a student, if they're unemployed, if they're disabled, and we'll look at their housing status. Now, the behavioral health system has grappled for many years in terms of how to judge outcomes for people, and the MOD system parallels in many ways the national outcome measures that have been developed by CMS and SAMHSA, which really looks at the functioning of a person. So what we'll be able to do and start to look at after we begin getting reports out of this system in July is what happens when people go into treatment, which I think really speaks to a lot of the questions that you've had over the last couple of days, which is how do we in a medical system, we can look at lab tests, for example. We can look at people's weights. We can look at their metabolic panels to see if our interventions have been successful. So for people who have complex substance and mental health issues, what we think we'll find, what we will find most useful is to look at their life status, their housing, their interface with the criminal justice system, they're staying in school, they're staying employed. So those are the kinds of data that we'll get out. After some discussions yesterday, I went back and looked at some information that we're collecting for the United States Department of Justice, and we did break out, for example, emergency room use, which has declined over the last 4 quarters for people with mental health needs. So to the extent that we will use data from the Medicaid and from the non-Medicaid system to help us assess programs. But the MOTS system really does get down to the client level. We'll be able to see if some programs are functioning better than other programs over time, and it'll be quite, I think, quite powerful. So I'm going to ask Janelle now to go over some of the budget slides with you.
Mm-hmm. The first budget slide is one that you've seen previously. It's the total OHA budget, but highlighting the slice that is addictions and mental health as 6% of our total Oregon Health Authority budget. The next slide shows the chart that breaks down the AMH budget by service, by major program area. The largest part is for the institutions at 44% of the budget, followed by community mental health at 42%, and small amounts for alcohol and drug treatment and prevention, and then 4% for program support and 1% for gambling. The next slide breaks it down, the budget down into the funding. 67% of this budget, $760 million, is general funds. 24% is federal funds, 8% other funds, with lottery funds at 1%, and then a couple small amounts for capital improvement. And the last slide is one we'll go into more detail on Monday, and it is the breakdown of the institution's budget.
Thank you. So now we're going to talk about budget drivers. We expect our forensic population to experience a decrease. This is true nationally as well. The number of serious crimes being committed is going down. It's being tied to the aging of the population of the United States, basically. So we're anticipating a 0.5% decrease. Whereas the population of people who receive civil commitment is projected to go up a little bit, like a 5% increase. The next budget driver for us is our work with the United States Department of Justice. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Olmstead decision, which was a 1999 U.S. Supreme Court case. It was brought in 1995 by the Atlanta Legal Aid Society on behalf of two women, Lois Curtis and Elaine Wilson. Both of these women had developmental disability and mental illness, and they had spent a very long time in institutions. I think Elaine had spent 26 of her less than 40 years in institutions. They were ready to go. They could have lived in the community, but there were no community services. So the Supreme Court decision actually affirmed that under the Americans with Disability Act, mental illness was a disability, so they were protected. And what that practically meant was that they were entitled to least restrictive environment and all of the other protections of the Americans with Disability Act, including what's called the integration mandate, which is that people with disabilities have a right to live in an integrated setting. Most states have a consent decree with the United States Department of Justice. In other words, they went to court, they had a ruling against them, and now they have court monitors, and they have a consent decree that's a legal document. Oregon has a unique situation. We have an agreement. We have a letter of agreement with the United States Department of Justice. We do not have a court monitor. So they're using Oregon really as a demonstration of how there can be a collaborative partnership between the United States Department of Justice and a state to go forward on these issues without without really going to court. So we've been working very intensely with them, and in the first year, data was collected. In the second year, looked for gaps. We've decided on our outcome measures. We've started producing, I think, very good reports for them, and now we're in some very intense discussions looking at outcomes because, you know, like all of us, we're interested in the outcomes. Our next meeting with them is in April. We meet with them quarterly, and we have intense discussions ongoing during that time. We have a very good team that works pretty much full time on gathering data, looking at our system, and they remain collaborative partners in this effort. There are expectations that we will close some of the gaps, especially around contact with the criminal justice system and some crisis services. But I think, as you've seen over the last couple of days, we're working very hard, and as are some amazing people in the field, to bring services closer to where people are by providing crisis services that provide that immediate intervention that deflects people. Next one. Where we do have one alarming trend, which is that the number of people who have been sent to the state hospital over the years, I think, sorry, this slide is, what is the first?
2010.
Okay, 2000, thank you. Between 2010 and December of 2014, there has been an alarming increase in the number of people who have been sent to the state hospital for aid and assist. And as you may know, we're working with the on a bill, House Bill 2420, and then there's also House Bill 2382 that relate to this. So the numbers may not appear huge, but in 2010, there were 90 people who went to the state hospital who had symptoms of mental illness, and it was felt that they were not able to aid and assist in their own defense. And Greg Roberts has some great presentations about this. Many, many of those people have misdemeanor charges or very low-level felony charges, Class C felonies. By 2014, we have almost double the number of people. The reason that's significant is that those people are taking up beds. And as you know, we have a problem with people being boarded psychiatrically because there aren't enough acute beds, and there is currently a waiting list to get in the state hospital. I looked at it last night. It was about 16. But if we had fewer people going in for these aid and assist evaluations that cost an average of $65,000 to do, if we could see some of those people in the community, then they would suffer less disruption. They would keep their homes, their pets, their stuff is undisturbed. And then we could wipe the waiting list off and just kind of have this entire flow. Now, I'm not saying that every one of these 150 people should be treated in the community to bring them to a level so that they can assist in their own defense. But people who have misdemeanors in particular, we need to have an evaluation done in the community. This, what we hope we would be doing is taking some funding to build this capacity in the community.
We can talk more about that. If you're interested, we can provide you with the information from the state hospital. We want these beds to be used appropriately because it's very expensive to have somebody at the state hospital. And it's not just the expense. I mean, again, for those of you and for myself who's worked with these folks, literally what happens is they're gone from a pretty fragile community situation for a couple months, and they've lost their place to live. Their pets have been given away or thrown out the door. Their stuff is in garbage bags stored in somebody's garage. It's really we really feel that this is something that will improve the situation tremendously. I mean, it is really the heart of the triple aim, you know, better care for people, a better outcome, and opening up our resources for people who genuinely need them. This is just a slide that just acknowledges that the shift in funding, as I mentioned before, with the non-Medicaid state general fund used to cover a lot of people who are indigent. As the number of people who are indigent goes down, there has been a shift in funding over to the Medicaid program where those people are being cared for. And that started in January of 2014. And it's led to an overall increase in the number of people who are getting services. So I mentioned the psychiatric boarding in emergency departments. Alleviating that problem is a key part of our strategic plan. We've started to have meetings with representatives from the 15 acute care hospitals, and we've moved that admission team over from AMH central office to the state hospital where they can be closer to the action. I think, as everybody is aware, there's a lack of affordable housing. It causes homelessness is the most obvious result of it. But I think that all the way along the continuum, it's difficult for people. And so, although when I went to school, nobody told me that as training to be a clinical psychologist that I would be involved with housing or with a lot of these other things, I think that we've all realized that the social determinants of health are just as important as anything else. And we've all educated ourselves about housing and employment and life in a community so that we're going to continue to work with community partners. Another problem that's being discussed a lot in Oregon and nationally are workforce issues. There's competition for a limited workforce. I've been in situations where you couldn't find a nurse. You couldn't find a nurse practitioner. You couldn't find physical therapists. We brought in a lot of physical therapists from the Philippines and found jobs for their spouses. I mean, it's a critical problem across the healthcare continuum. We have talked to the Transformation Center recently about partnering with the other entities who are working in a workforce to have a specific discussion about behavioral health. Psychiatry, the lack of psychiatric services is the most obvious, and the lack of board-certified child psychiatrists is acute nationally. The solutions are going to have to be multifaceted. There's only so much telehealth that can happen without face-to-face contact, and so we're going to have this. We're going to include the colleges and universities because some of the issues that the practitioners in the field are talking to me about is they get young people who are well trained clinically in the field, but they have to spend the next year training them around documentation and around working with integrated physical health teams. And so what we would like to do is to work with programs to talk to them about what their young people need going into these situations. I mean, documentation is a huge area. for the behavioral health folks are not as well trained as people on the healthcare side at this point in our evolution of integration. The other thing that happens is that when people receive their specialty training, and then they move. So retention is really important in this area as well. And wages had tended to be low for behavioral health, people in behavioral health. There may also be some licensing issues to look at. The other thing that we see coming down, a tsunami or a train or whatever you want to call it, is the legalization of marijuana is an unintended consequence that we pay attention to, is that when young people see marijuana on sale in retail stores, this normalizes the use of any substance. It's the same for alcohol. And we feel that we're going to have to redouble our efforts around prevention and education for young people around marijuana. So those are some of our budget drivers. So looking ahead, we have built performance measures into our contracts for our community mental health programs, just the way the CCOs have performance measures around access and other important areas of function, such as treatment engagement and follow-up, readmission, the number of evaluations that are done, and functional outcomes. We are putting those measures into all of our financial assistance agreements, which is also a requirement of all their providers putting information into our measurement and outcomes system. And this is why we feel that there will be some movement towards our ability to look at outcomes. The other thing that I think is incredibly important is to continue to support the efforts around integrated care. So most of the discussion around integration of care is a physical health center that has behavioral health clinicians available, or a physical health center that has a close relationship with a behavioral health group. And there are many, many ways of doing that. The particular integration efforts that we're involved in are behavioral health homes for people with severe and persistent mental illness. As we discussed earlier in the presentation, one of the tragic consequences of having mental illness is a lower lifespan. So the answer is to get good health care to people. So for people with severe mental illness, it's probably, for some people, a really good solution that they get their health care where they get their behavioral health, mental health care. So we're working with 10 organizations, facilities throughout Oregon. We've used a small CMS adult quality grant to bring together a learning collaborative. And just as primary care homes for, as there's been primary care homes have been built and certified for physical health, we're working on the same, along the same lines for behavioral health, so that an organization could strive to be a behavioral health home by having a certain level of health care for people in that setting. And this is going on all over now, so we have a number of model programs that are happening in Oregon, and they are helping inform that system. An opportunity that we're looking at is a pilot project that is being sponsored by the Center for Medicaid and Medicare, which is an excellence in mental health pilot. We had a national representative from the National Council on Behavioral Health come in and talk to us about this opportunity in January. And this is a Congress passed a bill, H.R. 4302, which includes a provision for excellence in mental health, and it's to create certified community behavioral health clinics. There's a $25 million grant that is out there, and Oregon has decided to apply for planning money. If you apply and receive the planning money, a portion of the $25 million of the planning grant, then you are eligible to be one of the 8 states to participate in the 2-year pilot. Now, I am not convinced that it's in Oregon's best interest to apply for the final grant, but we had a meeting with a number of stakeholders, and everyone agreed that there didn't seem to be any downside to applying for the planning grant. We're hoping to get between $500,000 and $1 million to plan, and then we'll see if we want to participate in the 2-year program. But and so we're working across the entire health authority and with our community partners around that. And then, of course, we've talked a lot over time about our strategic plan, and I think there are copies for you that will be passed out, as well as a calendar that we distributed that's around our gambling prevention program that's where the artwork is done by 7th graders. We thought you would maybe like copies of that, too.
Pam?
Yes?
We've only got 20 minutes left here.
And that is my last slide.
I know there's a lot of questions. And
that's my last slide.
How about we read last slide and I'll let the committee start asking questions? Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. A quick question on slide. I think we were on slide 44. When you mentioned that emergency room use has dropped from this segment of the population, can you say just a little bit more about that? Is that an indicator over just a first time period, or is there a solid trend over several different quarters?
It's a trend over 4 quarters. It was a measure that we agreed to collect with the United States Department of Justice, and it also is consistent with the overall information for the all Oregon Health Authority patients, and actually I think for Medicare patients as well across the state. My interpretation of it is that more people are enrolled in primary care homes and more people are using services appropriately. Well, 4 quarters is still just 4 quarters, and we'll be watching that carefully.
Thank you.
Representative Stork.
Thank you, Chair Bates. I have a number of questions, but before I ask all budget questions, on slide 50, you made reference to a projected increase of civil commitments by 4.7%, and I don't fully understand why we are assuming we'll have such an increase in civil commitments. Can you address that?
No, I can't, because the way the caseloads are projected is a complete mystery to me, because they've recently changed the model and methodology for the pricing growth, and the new model captures all of the caseload by population, but I confess I do not understand how they reach those conclusions.
But we can get you information.
Mr. Chair, Representative, mm-hmm. and I'd be glad to bring back some information. We have worked over the last 2 years to try and improve the methodology, and we still have data issues, and so, but let me bring something back for you.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have a follow-up?
Mine are on another topic, so.
Senator Winters?
Just quickly, and you can bring the information back. You talked about aid and assist. Would you actually tell me which counties has the highest utilization for aid and assist? I know that, see, we think alike here. You know, what counties that they're coming from?
We have that information. There are 4 counties. Marion County was the top.
But they're no longer doing that's because of the work that they're doing in Marion County. What I'm getting at, because you've got it as one of your budget drivers, and yet, you know, if a county is actually are not changing their methodology, it does become one of your budget drivers. However, you know, Marion County, you know, looked at that and then began to work through their DA and their sheriffs and their judges and others. So I think it's a lesson for us.
It certainly is. We provided $750,000 to Marion County in order for them to actually take their program to the next highest level, and they've done an amazing job.
And part of like, you know, the good senator and I met with Marion County, not only to talk about aid and assist, but to talk about what they have put in place here in Marion County that can be replicated in other parts of the state. And it's my understanding that that's why you want some presentation by Marion County to come before us.
Thank you. Pam, I'm going to follow up this question because it's the same one I had. And I was hoping that when you showed us that slide, which I've seen before, that you would have said, and here's the data that backs it up. Here's which counties by population where they're coming from. Show us which counties are sending people to the state hospital disproportionately to their population, and highlight which counties have not. And I would really love to see in a discussion from you that Marion County, over the last 7 or 8 years, has put programs together way before you gave them any money to start changing what was going on. And show what that cost figure looks like. Investments at the community level in your police and in your DA and in your community health, what the effect of that is of not putting people in the state hospital, not building Junction City, closing another ward at the state hospital, what that really means financially. I didn't see that kind of detail in that, just that we've got a problem and no solutions. I think there are solutions out there. But I would have loved to see that kind of information, not coming from Senator Winters and myself, but coming from you for the entire state and for this committee. It's really kind of information that lets us build policy in the right direction and make the right investments. I feel like we're being left in the dark sometimes, and I just need that information, and I want the committee to hear that information too. So that's not just a question, that's just a statement. Senator Stark, and then Senator Steiner Hayward.
Oh, Senator today.
Representative Stark.
Oh,
would
you wish that on me? Thank you, Chair Bates. Okay, so you're about to see my limited knowledge and my vast experience here in the legislature. I've been trying to learn more about OLCC funding. You know, I've been working really hard on trying to get funding and issues for a sobering center in Josephine County to resolve some of the local challenges and bring the community together. On page 48, or slide 48, and all these different funds that, you know, addictions and mental health receives money from, where does OLCC money fit into that? And this might be something somebody else answers for me. Where does OLCC money fit into that whole mix?
Karen's going to answer that question.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, and Representative Stark. The other fund revenue stream is where the beer and wine tax falls within our budget. Mm-hmm. And there's two sections to that. There's a 40% and a 20%. And we get the 40 and the 20 from OLCC. And then the other 40% goes directly to counties to operate prevention and treatment programs. Mm-hmm. So it's a matching relationship between the counties and the state.
Okay. And quick follow-up, we can deal with this one kind of offline, I guess. There's a couple funds that I have seen exist out there that I think you guys might have some authority over, but would love to connect with you specifically on those and kind of find out, you know, how those are used and where they go. So
I think she's next.
That's okay. Senator Steiner Hayward first, and then Representative Kenny Geyer.
I have four questions. I'm only going to ask one now. I'll email you the rest. And the question I would ask is, you talk about the lack of child psychiatrists, which I couldn't agree with you more. They're one of the critical access specialties that we don't have enough of in the state. I'd love to hear some thoughts, either now or soon, about the role of other qualified mental health professionals in decreasing the burden or their reliance specifically on psychiatrists. We absolutely need psychiatrists, don't get me wrong. And it's not an either or, it's a both and. But I'd really like some thoughts about other mental health professionals, because it's faster to train social workers. Psychologists are plus minus on the training time. It's probably a little closer, a little quicker than it is to train psychiatrists. So if we're talking about grow your own programs, we need to be thinking about that issue as well.
Senator Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward, that is why we feel we need to bring a large workforce conference together to continue these discussions and to put together the appropriate sub work groups.
Really quick follow up. So, Ms. Martin, the state already has a range of incentive programs for healthcare providers to meet the needs of the state. They do include, some of them do include psychiatrists. I don't think we have any that currently include other qualified mental health professionals. And while we may not be able to include those in this particular session, because the timing may not work, I'd really like to be closely involved in this conversation, because that issue of incentives is an important one, and it's a way to attract and retain folks like this to our state. And so it's probably a good use of taxpayer dollars, and we should be thinking about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Elizabeth Steiner, Senator Steiner Hayward on that, and I'm looking forward to the Senate bill that I hope makes it over to the House on workforce, looking at workforce needs. But I have four questions also, but I'll ask one. I wanted to get back to a question I asked about addictions when we started out. The budget you have on page 47 talks about addictions being 9% of the budget. And it seems like, I don't know what percent of people with mental health have an addictions issue, but it's addictions and mental health. It seems like a very small percent, if you think that that's a really key component to dealing with people who have mental health issues. I'm guessing that more than 9% of the population. So, and there's been some high visibility concerns in newspapers over the last few months. So I'm just wondering what kind of plan going forward, what role this addictions has, and whether you're looking at any kind of dramatic change in the 9% allocation.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, and Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for that question. Having spent 30 years now of my professional life focusing on addiction, it is something I think about every day. And in fact, the addiction system has been underfunded for quite some time, which is why we've had numerous stakeholder processes. We've reported on this. We have pretty close connections with the field, with the providers, and with the people who fund these services. And people really try to make their dollar stretch when it comes to providing addiction services. But there are people out there who do not get served, and which is why I'm very excited about ACA and the expansion of Medicaid in Oregon. We had an expanded Medicaid program before. We had one in the mid-90s. It was the OHP standard plan. And when we had that, we really had no waiting lists for addiction services. I was a provider then. We installed a phone in our waiting room because when somebody called the 1-800 number, they could get right then signed up for the Oregon Health Plan. We'd take them that very day and do an assessment and get them right into treatment. So I would like to think that those days are coming back. And from what I hear, providers are saying it's really positive. There are a lot of people that have a benefit. They're able to get into treatment. So we're able now to focus on what I was talking about yesterday, is keeping people in recovery. You can get treatment, and that's great. But it's a lifelong, chronic issue. Providing peer-delivered services and support services is something we can focus on now with the funding that we have. So it's a really good opportunistic time right now to address this issue.
Questions?
I just have a request, and we're going to get there, probably when we get into the detail, but I want to make certain that part of that detail talks about staff ratios, particularly at the state hospital, and also vacancies at the state hospital. And I want to walk through, and maybe this is an offline, and I need to talk to you about it, your internal hiring and promotional practices at the state hospital.
So as chair, I'm going to take a moment and try to direct your attention as a committee to a couple of things and bring up to date as much as I can on what I know is going on in the community that has not been touched upon so far, and I'll get you out of here. The slide you're seeing in front of you, slide 47, if you step back and think about it, tells us two things, that we have two very wrong priorities, one of which has already been touched on. First wrong priority is that half the money is going into institutional care.
Right.
It's inappropriate. We have to start changing that. The other one is what Representative Kenny Geyer talked about, drug and alcohol issues. What you don't see here is that there's another 5,000 people you don't see on the slide who are receiving treatment as a result of mental illness, and they are in our correction system. 5,000 people are there because of that. Inside that correct system, 71% of the people there have a drug and alcohol problem. So we have wrong priorities here, and it's been built up over the years, and we're not addressing those priorities the way we should. There are four or five programs in the state which are not just pilot projects, but which I believe are actually change products. The first one's occurring in the Tri-County area, which is half the population of the state. They are trying to change what I call the front door. They're developing a program to stop stacking in ERs for people who are in acute crisis using what's called the Alameda model. It's a partial model. They believe they can get people who are in crisis out of their facility in 24 hours by stabilizing them with 24/7 psychiatrists being available. So it's a consortium with OHSU, Legacy, Kaiser, and Adventist. If they are successful in that, in 18 months from now, we'll see some changes. Their goal is to divert people away from prison, away from state hospital. That's half the population of the state. That initiative has not been brought forward by AMH or by state government. It's been brought forth by the community members there, and I applaud them for it. Roseburg is going to try to do the same thing, a little different level. Bend has contacted us wanting to do the same thing a little different way also. We haven't got time to go through those. Josephine County has just called wanting to step in.
Hmm.
And as this, they're talking to each other. I tried to stop that, but they're talking to each other. And I believe our job in this session is probably to get out of their way and support them in any way we can. I don't believe we're going to tell them what to do. This is something that's come up from our communities. They see the problem. They're tired of waiting for us. They're sick and tired of what's going on in the state, and they're stepping up and helping us, and I appreciate that. They have significant barriers. One of the big barriers is adequate housing. When people leave that front door, whether it's community mental health or a primary care home or actually leaving the hospital and going to someplace that's safe, that has the right wraparound services. They're talking about something I am not very familiar with, which sounds like the right thing to do, using peer services, people who have been through the system and who are trusted by people who are now going through the system. It's something we really need to step up on. We're going to have to help them with housing, and we're going to have to help them with those front doors. We want people out of the ERs. We want them out of prison. We don't want them in the state hospital, with all due respect to the people of the state hospital. A year in the state hospital is somewhere north of $250,000 a year. That is something that's not sustainable. This budget will grow to be entirely institutional care if this continues. So we have an opportunity, committee, to change things this year. I'm asking for your support and supporting our local communities and what they're trying to do. I'm asking for support from AMH to support them also. Let's move things forward in the right direction. As far as workforce is concerned, I think we have an answer before us that we have not looked at carefully. We're going to compete in this state for psychiatrists, psychologists, and other healthcare workers, and we're not going to be successful. This is a bad state to come to as a doctor. We have legal aspects as far as malpractice is concerned. The pay is low. We are not going to compete very successfully. We'll do the best we can. We also have a shortage now of residencies and a mismatch between residencies and medical schools. This state is the most popular state for nurse practitioners to come to in the United States. They have the most open ability to practice of any state in the union. I believe that's where our answers are going to lie. I think we're going to take nurse practitioners and train them to a higher level in mental health so they can be experts in it. I have one nurse practitioner working in a nursing home in my area. I call her to ask questions about medications, and I'm not embarrassed to do so. Her knowledge is better than mine, and it's faster to get a hold of her to do it. I think that's one of the areas that we have to look at and go to. There are answers out there. We can do this, but we need AMH to step up and lead. We need outcomes. We can't just keep throwing money at programs like we did last session. I know that Senator Courtney did a great job putting money into the system. He and I disagree on this. Disagree because I thought we just threw it out there and hope for the best. I don't want to hope for the best anymore. I want to go into proven programs that really work. I'll stop there. And is there any other questions? Please speak up. I'm going to get us out of here 4 minutes early. We have a lot of work to do, but I want us to focus on mental health in this session and support our local partners, who I think are doing some great work out there.
Just amen.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I will call this public hearing to an end.
Thank you.